Vi har flyttet ut, oss ut I messesalen. Mm. Ut der hvor det altså, ut der hvor det utstillet. Og jeg må nesten ta film av dette her, for at vi har jo satt oss veldig fint til med bakgrunnen her, men hvis du ser på bildene av ambulansene her, så markerer jo det 50-årsjubileum på Ambulanseforum. Uansett, så har jeg dratt med meg disse kara her. Det jeg sleit med å si navnet ditt I sted, og så hvis jeg sa det feil, så var det idiot. Altså, Daniel Creighton, det riktig?
That's right,
ja. Og Carl Robert Christiansen, eller Christiansen, eller jeg husker forrige gang så sleit litt med det.
Carl Christiansen, det veldig hyggelig å være tilbake.
Ja, du har vært med før, du også.
Ja.
Daniel, du advanced paramedic. Du har hatt et foredrag her nå på Ambulanseforum. Og du jobber da nede I England. Jeg skal fortelle litt om det senere. Men det som heldigvis for meg da, så har han jobbet som fysioterapeut I Kristiansand. Og bodde I Danmark, så han pratet dansk. Så da slipper dere å høre på min forferdelige engelsk.
Nei, en telekall engelsk, kan man si.
Så du kommer til å prate, jeg kommer til å snakke norsk, og yeah. så svarer du på engelsk.
Engelsk, ja.
Det greit. Carl Robert, vi tar litt hvorfor du her også. Det jo en sammenheng her på en måte.
Altså, ja, det ikke det?
Jo, det jo på en måte det. Du hadde et innlegg først om hvordan dere jobber der nede. Du ble mer nysgjerrig på det. Du fikk jo veldig kort tid. 20 minutter kanskje? Hvor langt hadde du?
25, ja.
25 minutter. Ja. Vi vil høre mer. Det kan vi ta nå. Mm. Og Carl Robert, kan nevne da at det handler om utdanning, rett og slett.
Skal vi si det var ikke tilfeldig at jeg fikk slotten etter den?
Nei, det var ikke det.
Det kan hende at det var planlagt.
Ja, det kan hende. Så, du kalte den Dan?
Dan.
Fortell meg, du jobber som advanced paramedic I England.
Ja.
Hvordan arbeidsdagen din?
So yeah, I've been working as a paramedic in the UK for some time now. 2007 I started. And over those years I've gone from being an EMT to a paramedic and now an advanced paramedic. And I've chosen the route of urgent emergency care or community care, as you quite often call it. So since 2012 I've been an advanced paramedic, 2013 an advanced paramedic. And the joys this brings really are the variety that it gives you. It gives you so many kind of experiences and along with the sort of baseline paramedic work, we do additional work and manage a larger caseload of patients with chronic conditions, work very closely with local general practitioners, GPs, Elmin Lea, and other resources, physios, occupational therapists, etc. Have a good close working relationship with these guys. We're still called out to critical incidents, but quite often as first on scene or second on scene, but not as a primary critical care paramedic. We're there to support and back up. So there's always that baseline of keeping your paramedic skills sharp, but also taking on the additional skills of working in urgent care.
Let's just jump in there, just to bring context to everyone. That actually, you train as a paramedic, you work as a paramedic, and after being a paramedic, you can specialize really in two routes. And you've specialized into urgent care, which we often call community care, or legevaktsmedisin.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one you just refer to as critical care, which sort of, in Norway is sort of luftambulansen, legeambulansetjeneste, mansesilege. So you've got critical care specialization and urgent care, community care specialization. But you're community care oriented, that's your speciality.
That's right. I think the background of physiotherapy really lent itself quite nicely to that.
Yeah.
Because you see chronic conditions and you support patients in a kind of low acuity setting rather than the high acuity setting you might do in a critical care environment. Yeah. And I think our workload realistically is probably 80 to 90% urgent or community care, and the last 10% is the high acuity critical care. So for my mind, it made sense to have that broad specialism to be able to ensure you can work and see the biggest number of patients and make the biggest impact on patient care.
Yeah.
Men da kan du fortelle litt om hvordan systemet lagt opp der nede da? Fordi at altså, hvis man kaller det legemaktsmedisin, og man jobber som paramedic der nede, hvordan vet du systemet I Norge, for eksempel?
Yeah,
hva skiller seg?
I've got an idea, and I think one of the main differences is probably the the lack of things being doctor-led in the UK. We're extremely autonomous, very fortunate. We have a medical director, the sort of top clinician within the trust, the ambulance trust. But other than that, we don't have much to do with the doctor. We don't necessarily see doctors on a regular basis. We are left to be autonomous and manage our caseload, manage our patients autonomously. I do communicate lots with doctors from a clinical perspective, discussions, shared decision-making, that sort of thing. But on the whole, I can manage my caseload without the need to call a doctor or call any other specialists.
Hvordan type behandlinger kan det være da, for eksempel?
So a typical shift, for example, might be starting at 6 o'clock, taking over from my colleague. They're normally 11 and a half to 12 hour shifts, and predominantly on the car, the solo response vehicle or SRV. I go in, as you would do here, get the bags. We have them delivered in a package from the make ready centers. So I don't have to search for things. I turn up and there is my equipment for the day. And then go into an omni-cell room where I get the drugs, the extended range of drugs that I have. Antibiotics, pain medication, steroids, local anesthetic for suturing, things like that. Specific end-of-life care medication that I might give patients at the end of their life. I might support palliative care. I get that fingerprint system and it's administered through a box in a kind of cooled environment, all quite high-tech. It has to be witnessed by somebody. I take that along with my equipment in the car, and then I might get the iPad out, or I might, if I'm on station, go up to a computer, log into our CAD, so our clinical system where you can see the patients waiting, and I'll look at the patients in the area and see which ones are appropriate. More often than not, first thing in the morning, there's the elderly fallers, people that have fallen overnight, early in the morning, and they're still on the floor. And then I'll look, see who's been on the floor longest, because I think they need the care, or if they've got comorbidities on the notes, I can see the notes and I'll cherry pick those. Quite often I'll look at the ones that are closest logistically. So I have to manage, if there's two or three patients waiting, I'll look at which route is going to be best to see the most patients. I'm always ready for a category one call, so a cardiac arrest if it comes in and I'm the closest resource, but otherwise I'll go and see those patients. The first patient
so
might...
So you actually go in and you look at the list and you pick your patients. Yeah. Oh, I think I'll be good at that and that and I can make a difference here.
Yeah.
And you just pick them from the list.
That's right.
That's brilliant.
That's right. Yeah, it gives you great ownership and autonomy and you feel, actually, it's down to me to make that difference.
And I guess, I mean, you've got training and you know that training, I can do something with this, but maybe not with that.
Yep, exactly. And I think the placements we have during training also allow you to see what's done with that patient if they come into hospital or into an Elmine lay or general practitioner. So you understand the consequences of seeing and treating that patient and you understand what you can do and what perhaps are outside your limitations and what the doctors should be doing in hospital. So from that perspective, it's really useful having a really broad understanding of the health system.
Sorry, I took you away from the great example.
Okay.
So just go ahead.
So I might drive out to this patient. If I'm in any doubt, I could call the patient if there's family nearby or family with them. I could call the patient to get a bit more investigation or understanding before I go out and see them. Because it might be 2 hours away or an hour and a half away. Sometimes just a few more questions to ensure actually I am the most appropriate resource. Or they're on rivaroxaban or an anticoagulant that they've had a head injury. Maybe I'm not the best person for that. Maybe they do need a CT, they do need to be seen. In which case, there's no point me going out there. I would then upgrade that call and send an ambulance. And I would wait and cherry pick through the list. So if I go out and see that patient, say they were appropriate, I arrive on scene, assess the scene, obviously, as you would do, get information from the patient or from family or neighbours on scene, and then I just assess the patient on the floor, find out if it's a minor injury, low acuity injury that either A, I could deal with. Quite often we get skin tears, skin flaps, skin issues with elderly patients. If you've been on long-term steroid use, your skin tends to be quite thin. Then I can use Steri-Strips, I can use our dressings to clean, irrigate, clean the wound, dress it appropriately, ensure the patient's okay, that I assess their mobility, they're able to sit and stand, they're able to move around and conduct or take any ADLs, activities of daily living, they're able to sort of maintain that, look after themselves autonomously. And then I'd perhaps call the district nurse to say that is a risk of infection here, can you come and see them in 5 days, leave the patient with some advice, call appropriate next of kin or family members if they need some advice as well. If the patient's high risk, I might call the GP or send the GP an email to say, I've seen this patient, this is what happened. I got her off the floor. She was absolutely fine when I left her. No sign of head injury, no signs of any cardiac issues, respiratory issues. It was an isolated wound that happened from an extrinsic fall. So she tripped over a rug or something like that due to poor balance at that age. And then I might just leave the patient with advice, appropriate safety knitting, ask if she's got any questions, any the expectations are met. no medical needs at all. I've assessed everything. I go back into the car, get the iPad out, and I might look for the next job from the scene. I won't travel back to station because more often than not, it's better to stay in the community.
Yeah. So that way, you actually avoid hospitalisation and unnecessary hospitalisation.
Yep.
Since she's up and mobile, she doesn't have a neck or femur fracture.
Yep.
She's up and she can actually take care of herself. And say, you know what, with some advice, you can stay at home.
That's right.
It's fantastic
to
avoid hospitalisation like that.
Completely. And if she did need, say there was a higher risk of infection and the wound was deeper, it needed suturing, I could administer some antibiotics, some prophylactic antibiotics, just to ensure that the patient's covered from an antibacterial perspective, if needed. And if I want to get more information, I call the GP and I just ask for the patient records. I ask to provided it's within working hours, gain an understanding of the patient's history, if there's any chronic conditions, anything I should be aware of. Invariably, if the patient's in long-term care, she'll have good notes. And we use a lot of the sort of leadership and quality improvement areas to ensure that our care homes, by communicating with them, have good notes for their patients. Then anyone who has ongoing sickness and needs help at home, they have good communication with the ambulance crew, because it's vital. We need that information.
Men alltså de casen du beskriver här, det är ju som jag tänker på, alltså det är ju caser som är det som på något sätt kommunala problem då, alltså du så patienter som alltså du ska tillse alltså sårställ och sån typ av ting, men som inte alltså är det Hvis du kjenner systemet i Norge for eksempel, er dette du kan sikkert svare på, Carl, er dette type blir det som en type legevakt, sånn som legevaktsbilene, der hvor det er det
Det var nok derfor jeg brukte ordet legevaktsmedisin tidligere i praten vår også. Det klart at det jo en grensegang mellom ambulansetjeneste og det som på en måte kommer fra primærhelsetjenesten.
Ja, og hvor er den her?
Ja, for ambulansetjenesten rykker jo ut til oppdrag som man tror i det man rykker ut kanskje er noe for spesialisthelsetjenesten og ambulansetjenesten, og så kommer man frem og så ser man at dette her er jo egentlig primærhelsetjenesten. Kanskje du skal kjøre det til en legevakt, eller vi litt usikre. Utfordringen jo at ambulansetjenesten ganske lav terskel for å da transportere til sykehus, fordi vi en del av spesialisthelsetjenesten. Men når man først kommer ut der og så ser disse pasientene, så det en del ting vi fra ambulansetjenesten strengt talt med mer trening og kompetanse og ansvar kanskje bare kan håndtere direkte. Og kanskje særlig i en verden nå hvor vi har mer sentraliserte legevakter også med interkommunale legevakter. Det lengre transport. Dette pasienter som kanskje, selv om det rent medisinsk sett tilhører primærhelsetjenesten, så kommer de seg ikke til legevakten. Det vi som kjører dem til legevakten. Men så viser det at det kanskje like greit at vi bare tilser dem med en gang og gjør oss ferdig og så kommuniserer med legevaktstjenesten eller fastlegen og bare informere dem om at vi har vært hos. Dette nå dagens status. Så dette nok en del av det, at vi må begynne å tenke, vi har tenkt på dette som siloer, spesialisthelsetjenesten som en silo og primærhelsetjenesten som en annen silo, men ambulansetjenesten jo på mange måter broen, opererer i en sånn gråson imellom. Og dette nok et sånt uttrykk for det, tror jeg.
Men hvis du går på type, din rolle i de akutte setningene da, hva vil det være? Vi skal gå litt på utdanning og sånt nå etterpå, men du sier at det er type sekundæroppdrag, kan man kalle det det?
Yeah, the first job. So the next job on that shift might be a cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
So then I have to think not urgent care but critical care. And I'm second on scene, say, as a support, an advanced paramedic support. I get on scene and then I'll manage the scene or ensure that everything's carried out correctly, that the crew that are involved are able to conduct their resuscitation appropriately. If I need to, I can swap and get involved, but more often than not, I've managed the scene. Use the leadership skills that I've been taught as an advanced paramedic to manage that scene, manage the staff and the patient and the family's welfare during that one. And that might then take up the next hour or an hour and a half of my shift with that one. Invariably, I won't travel with the patient to hospital unless, of course, the crew aren't necessarily capable of doing it themselves for various reasons, whether their training isn't appropriate. Then, in which case, I would get in the back of the ambulance and I'd continue to treat that patient en route to hospital.
Mm.
They would then follow in my car so that I can take the car from hospital and carry on my day from a self-dispatching perspective. And then it might be, from that perspective, I might go on to an end-of-life care patient, a palliative care patient, where I'm called either as backup from a crew who are there dealing with distressed relatives or a distressed patient, and sometimes even opposing views from a local GP or an out-of-hours GP. But actually, the patient's family desire to stay at home, the patient in their advance directive have asked to stay at home, but an out-of-hours doctor only necessarily sees what they read on the screen. That patient needs to go in, they're at the end of life, we need to treat them. But actually, when we look in the notes, and then I can have a respectful dialogue with the GP to explain the situation and explain how I have just-in-case medication. I can treat the patient, treat the breathing difficulties, treat secretions, I can treat seizure activity, I can treat pain as well and comfort, and ensure the patient is left at home as they've desired and able to have a dignified death. Mm. That might then involve some debriefing with the staff afterwards, particularly if they've had difficult discussions with carers, with family, excuse me, or with medical professionals. And after that, I'll clear up, green up, and go into the car and then select the next job that I go to.
Dette er sånne turer som tar veldig lang tid erfaringsmessig, sånn som jeg forteller nå.
De tar lang tid, og så tar det tiden til to personer I en ambulanse som kan transportere pasienter. Og så har vi jo ikke spisset opplæring mot end of life care, eller hvordan forlate pasienter, og hvordan safety nettet, og sånn. Så jeg tenker at det at vi har som en person spesialisert mot det, med egen kompetanse til å håndtere det, så man kan unngå en del unødvendige transporter, Og en ting korte distanser I en storby, men kan sette oss på å transportere til en legevakt som I nabokommunen, eller to kommuner ned, eller til et sykehus som to timer å kjøre. Ja, tenk på den belastningen det for pasienten, å måtte bli transportert så langt, hvis det ikke nødvendig. Hvis det unødvendig transport, og de skal ikke bare til sykehus eller til legevakten, de skal jo tilbake også. Hvis man kan håndtere det der og da med en gang. But curious briefly, I mean, you described two very interesting situations, but just briefly, could you just come with a few quick examples of other types of patients you would see?
So the next one on that shift could be a three-year-old who's fallen and cut their chin, for example. I would go and assess the patient, assess the family, ensuring that social care is there, that they're able to look after. There wasn't a non-accidental injury, that actually it was just a pure accident. I'd then clean the wound, glue it up, and identify that no need for further treatment. I could manage that patient. I may refer them if needed or give the patient's family advice. Yeah. More often than not, I can see that the family are quite well established. They know what they're talking about. They're not first time parents or whatever it is. And I leave them with that patient in care. Worsening care advice and safety netting for that patient. So that could be quite a quick turnaround, that sort of patient. And I think that's really where it's key, that you look at the patients that you can make the biggest difference in, not necessarily the shortest amount of time, but the most appropriate amount of time. Because if you choose a patient that is perhaps suffering with mental health issues, you know that job's gonna, you've gotta talk them down from a bridge, it's gonna take you 3 hours plus. That might not be the best use of my time. It might be because the crew on scene are junior and they haven't necessarily got the best rapport with that patient. Then perhaps it is a good idea for me to come. But I think, there are some jobs that occur quickly. Administering antibiotics for a urinary tract infection in a care home with a patient who's got dementia, is showing signs of being confused, agitated, but actually we've identified the root cause as a urine infection. I've ensured via the GP that the patient's liver function is okay, that there's no issues with, no concerns with being administering this type of antibiotic, and then she'll have some antibiotics for the care staff to administer and give her, and we'll happily leave her at home with worsening care advice. So there's a couple of the examples. Mm. Happy to think of more examples if you want, but it's
brilliant.
I think the biggest point really is here we're generalists. Mm. So I quite often say to the team that I work with, we can go to anything, really. As advanced paramedics in urgent care, we can go to anything. We may not be specialists in critical care, but we can go and support, and we are paramedics. And also cherry-picking the jobs that you feel are suitable, quite often I'll take the low-hanging fruit first, the ones that I know I can make a quick turnaround. If there aren't any, then I'll go to anything. I'll go to a neck of femur and I can administer pain relief, I can administer, TLC, I can support the environment, I can ensure the patient's off the floor or they're warm, they're not suffering with hypothermia. So I can put that into the system if I need to, but I think more often than not, I'm better suited elsewhere. But in times of, where the sort of jobs that are outstanding are low, I may revert to, as we discussed a bit earlier, looking at what is going on across the trust. So as an advanced paramedic, I don't just look at my area, I don't just wait to see the calls coming in, I've got a big picture of what's happening in the east of the Trust, in the west of the Trust, in the north and the south of the Trust. And if I could see, actually, we're okay today. We're quite far, we're happy. We've not got many patients waiting. But over there, in Thanet or Ashford or another part of southeast England, they're really struggling. Mm. They're waiting hours in the hospital car park. Actually, maybe I'll go back to station, I'll jump on the clinical hub, and I'll start calling some of those patients in Ashford or an area.
What's the clinical hub?
Clinical hub is a room on an ambulance station, mm. and all big major ambulance stations have an advanced paramedic hub, basically. Mm. And it's a hub with two or three terminals with three screens where you can see activity across the Trust. You've got a global overview of the resources that are being used, of the waiting times for patients at hospitals, but also waiting times for ambulances as well.
It's a bit like the control centre, really. The same overview as
yes,
the control centre.
But a mini control centre on each station.
Yeah.
And you are able to kind of identify where needs are, and then I can then revert my attention to that area. So, as I said, if it's quite a quiet, we don't like using the Q word because it brings bad luck, yeah, but yeah. if it is a quiet period, I can then turn my attention to a neighbouring area, and I can actually help them. And by talking to and treating the low acuity calls on the phone remotely enables the ambulance crews to be freed up for the more critical patients in that area. There's nothing worse when you're stuck with a patient that you feel doesn't necessarily need to go to hospital mm. and you hear that radio broadcast, there's mm. a cardiac arrest mm. around the corner. I can't just ditch this patient, but I know I should be doing that one. And that's where I can come in and I can talk to that patient remotely, free these guys up to go and sort the cardiac arrest out.
So just let me get this right. So you've been out doing, seeing patients. There's no more patients in your area, so you go back to your station. You've got a mini medical call center in your station where you see whatever's going on in your whole service. And far away, you see there's big pressure, lots of jobs queuing up. Sorry, the yeah. queue word.
No, yeah, quiet yeah. is the word we don't use. Right. Queuing is fine.
Queuing is fine, yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. So you see jobs queuing up, and then you go, and then you call back to the patients and you say, and then you do sort of more investigations and talk more to the patient next of kin and actually give them advice over the phone. And maybe decide they don't need an ambulance and yeah. then...
Yeah, and in times of pressure, particularly during COVID, particularly yeah. with children. I have many calls overnight mm. where actually it's more appropriate for that child to get in the back seat of their mum or dad's car mm. and drive to a local hospital. They get the same treatment, they'll have the same waiting time, mm. but they'll free up an ambulance for mm. that. The child isn't, you know, critically ill. If they were, obviously I'd get an ambulance there yeah. and I'd upgrade the call. I could see the grade it's been given first off, and actually they've deteriorated since the call taker took the call, or they've improved. Mm. And maybe they don't need to see anybody today. Maybe they can wait till tomorrow morning. Mm. So it really just frees up the resources to enable them to do what they've been trained to do, what they want to do, and what the Trust needs them to do, really.
Mm. That's impressive, yeah.
It gives you a sense of satisfaction yeah. that you know you can make an impact. Because that's what we all want out of mm. our jobs. Mm. We want to make it feel like we're making a difference. We're helping people. Mm. And whether I'm helping them face-to-face, which I love, or whether you're helping them remotely. It took us a bit of getting used to doing the remote stuff because mm. we aren't necessarily designed as paramedics to be sitting indoors. We like the outdoors. We like to be in the elements. But I think there's pros and cons. The pro being you can see multiple patients in a shift. Mm. You can.
Ja, vi holder på en podcast, Anders. Ja. Ja, vi får ta det etterpå. Var sjefen og ville ha et par ord, ja, vi får ta det etterpå.
But essentially what you're saying is that parts of your shift you might be out seeing patients, and when it suddenly gets quiet, you go in and you just sit at the call center and you phone patients and just talk to patients who are in an area far, far away, just to relieve pressures in other areas. That's brilliant.
Yeah, so I mean, we have rostered shifts where that is what we're supposed to be doing that day. Yeah. But I think during the times where actually my need is better served elsewhere, we have the flexibility to do that.
It's just interesting also just from a worker perspective, having the dynamics of sometimes being outside and then, you know, in the middle of the shift you go inside yeah. or probably vice versa as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Must be an interesting sort of job.
It is, but yeah. I think you, as I said, that ownership yeah. aspect gives you more of a desire to improve the service.
Yeah.
And that's where the leadership piece comes in, identifying a need for quality improvement, seeing actually the service needs a different approach today, and let me provide that, because I have the skill set to do that.
Mm. Men hvor lenge har dere holdt på? Hvor lenge har dere hatt en praksis med advanced paramedic?
So since 2013, I qualified as a paramedic practitioner, and then in 2015-16, we started using the title advanced paramedic, and that sort of came in and became the norm across the...
Og hvorfor så dere behovet?
Sorry?
Hvorfor så dere behovet for å ha spesialiserte...
Say, yeah, I think that we saw in some of the talks today that recruitment is challenging. And I think having an advanced paramedic, that next level of clinician, gives paramedics something to aspire to be, something to work towards, career progression. It enables you to join the job thinking, actually, there are other levels, there are layers, there's more competencies I can learn. There's nothing worse than stagnating. Mm. And I think if you stagnate, then the service doesn't evolve and improve and develop. And this gives that opportunity. It also gives us the opportunity to give back to staff. Because we're giving allocated time to supervise, mentor, to ensure people are all singing from the same hymn sheet. And everyone understands that wider picture, which is really beneficial.
But I guess also, I mean, I think it's career progression and keeping people in the job is a good thing. But I think also at the same time, I think what we've been doing now is we get more and more jobs every year. We're not really getting more and more sick patients. We're just getting more jobs. Mm-hmm. And until now, we've just added more and more ambulances.
Yeah.
But I think people start, the clinically start to deteriorate because less and less people require the type of help an emergency ambulance provides. Mm, and I think it's not a sustainable option, no. Just adding more and more ambulances. And at the same time, we get more and more elderly requiring help. Mm. And I just noticed how NICE, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence, advises to have more advanced paramedics. Because they can reduce hospital admissions by 13%. Mm. And of course, driving patients to the hospital, having them admitted, takes resources and money and is not necessarily in the patient's best interest.
No.
So I guess it's also, just from a public expenditure and how to use health resources, probably a good thing as well to reduce hospital admissions and to reduce unnecessary conveyance of patients.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the flip side, as you well know, we're training staff to a very high level these days. And if all you're doing is transport, then there's no job satisfaction in that.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to be using that sort of wonderful brain they've got, you know, using those clinical skills and the clinical decision making that you're taught throughout university, and we're putting that into practice. And we were seeing that staff were going elsewhere where they get those challenges. Staff were leaving and joining general practice, and actually we can allow them to support general practice, but from within the ambulance service. It means that we keep staff, we don't have huge attrition rates, they have a place to aspire to work towards, and recruitment isn't a problem either. We get staff in because they realize there's a career ladder for them. So it's win-win, I think, for everybody.
Absolutely. So essentially, a lot of your job is decision making, assessment of decision making about who does not need conveyance or does not need to be transported to a hospital, but where there are other suitable alternatives. Being at home is one of them, but being referred to your GP the day after, the following day, or advice with worsening care advice.
Yep.
And then also treating a few of these at home as well, the sutures and pain medication and end of life care, which we normally would have transported for a quick suture and then driven back again, you just treat on site.
Yep.
So it's a bit of both, really, a bit of treatment and a bit of just assessment decision making.
It is. And I think the role as an urgent care or an advanced paramedic in urgent care is also to be the referral champion. So we have links to all alternative referral pathways. So we can actually support the GP by going directly to the diabetes team, the heart failure team, the respiratory nurses, to the community district nurses, to whoever we need to. And that way we alleviate or lighten the GP's load. We don't have to send it to the GP, who becomes a middleman, who then refers it on to that community service.
Yeah, and I specifically like the thing that you're in dialogue with the district nurse, or hjemmesykepleien, which would be in Norwegian.
Yep.
And that he also can send a note to the GP or to fastlegen. So then you assess the patient. Instead of having the GP assess them again, you just inform the GP, your patient fell today, this might have been a repeated event, she's now fine, but heads up, you know, you're informed, you're in the loop.
That's
brilliant, yeah.
It does.
So it's a contact with, so you're actually in dialogue with the primary care services.
That's right, and part of the rota we have allows us to go and spend time with these teams. So if I wanted to spend a day with the palliative care, the hospice team, just to understand the treatment patients get and how the palliative care at home team works, I go and spend a day with them. That builds that bridge, it networks with the community services and gives us the ability to have that dialogue.
So it ligger I arbeidsplanen?
Yes, I have specific time designated for operational unit support or skills assurance time, self-development time, to maintain that. So I might go over to, it might be a district nurse, it might be a diabetes specialist, because I'm feeling a little bit rusty managing patients with diabetes. Let me spend a day with them. Then I can see how they manage the caseload. Mm. Or a mental health support worker, go and spend a day with them. It's really valuable time.
Mm. That's awesome, yeah.
If you go a little bit on training now, is this an intern course or a master's degree? How is the training for to be Altså, yeah. Sånn som jeg skjønte nå, så det advanced practitioner, altså
advanced clinical practice.
Yeah. Ja, og så det critical care practitioner. Det to forskjellige
ting. So, I guess you're an advanced care practitioner, which is you're a paramedic, and then you become an advanced care practitioner. Mm. But the ACP, the advanced care practitioner, you can have two different specialities. One is urgent care, which we in Norway often call, referred to as community care, or legevaktmedisin. And the other specialty is critical care, eller akuttmedisin. That would be right, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, both of them are a three-year master's program now, mm-hmm. and you join and you'll have some modules that are communal, they're similar. The education, the leadership, the clinical assessment module, the baseline medical model, the leadership module, those will be shared between urgent and critical care. Because there's lots of crossover there. And then you might branch out and have specific modules on, you know, it might be minor injuries, minor illness, might be a palliative care module, it could be a drugs and therapeutics or pharmacology module. Whereas the critical care guys would have a resuscitation module, a neuro, what's the module they do? The cardio-neuro module. And they'll have critical care specific modules that they do. So they kind of branch out to their specialities and they come back together. Come back together for the quality improvement module as well, which is the previously defined as a dissertation module. So at the end of their project, it's only a 30 credit module, so it's quite small, which is nice for a lot of non-academic paramedics. It's a smaller, more tangible module. And the idea is you start this quality improvement project and it continues in the trust after qualification. Oh. So rather than just being put on the shelf, that's my dissertation, I actually continue it when I'm working and I can see the benefits of my academic work, which is really rewarding.
So you say it's a three-year master's, but it's a master's degree, but you do it part-time so that you work, but it's essentially a master's degree.
Yeah.
But you do it part-time while you work at the same
time.
That's
right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So you're abstracted, but typically a day a week you're abstracted to attend university. And in the urgent care master's, I've managed to get an agreement with the local general practitioners, Elminlea, where our students every Thursday attend a practice and they work in that practice every Thursday for 2 years. So they do the first year to get the underpinning theory. After that, they go out every Thursday in general practice. So Thursday they might be working with a doctor, a general practitioner in a clinic, and then on the Friday they'll be back on the ambulances or back on the car, and that knowledge can then be thrown into to both settings, so transferable knowledge, which is really useful. And invariably, once they finished, they continued to have some form of affiliation to the general practitioners, maybe a bank contract or a part-time contract, and they have almost a rotational role that they've created themselves.
Okay.
Yeah.
Så
er det noe som
konkurrerer for oss om tiden? Jeg tror vi kanskje flytter oss, eller tar en pause. Så tar vi pause, så kan vi snakke litt om, altså litt mer, fortsette litt på utdanninga og sånt. Da vi tilbake. Vi måtte bare ha en liten pause her, fordi det skjer litt grann i messesalen her nå. Det litt grann, utstillerne har litt grann demoer og sånt nå, så da ble vi rett og slett ukonkurrert på lyd, tror jeg. Men vi skulle prate om utdanning.
Ja, men før vi skulle snakke om utdanning, det snakket vi litt igjen om i pausen, fordi nå Dan snakker mye om den kliniske delen av arbeidet sitt. Mm. Men hvis jeg har skjønt det riktig, så det sånn at innenfor advanced care practice, når du en advanced care practitioner, så snakker de på en måte om fire pilarer du jobber innenfor. Så, just, can you take us through the four pillars of practice? Because clinical work is one pillar,
yes.
Right? Yeah. So what are the other pillars?
So we're moving towards calling it advanced practice, which it used to be called, and I think the advanced clinical practice is a mouthful. And advanced clinical practice would imply that it's clinical practice, but actually it's not. It's advanced practice across four pillars, clinical being one of them, and pretty much the strongest, the most familiar, the one we love, the one we will lean towards, and the one we're best at often.
Yeah. Mm.
We've also got other pillars that are education, leadership, and research. And this isn't to say that you need to be equally good at all four pillars. You might have a strong clinical pillar, a less strong leadership, and even less strong education, and then research is something you need to improve upon, but it's there. Depending on your role, we have managers and leaders within the ambulance service that are also ACPs, and their management leadership pillar is stronger by far. But in the course, we teach separate modules. We have a leadership module, an advanced clinical education module, and we obviously have the research modules, two of them. Implementation improvement science and the quality improvement project, as I mentioned at the end. That's where the research component comes in. But I think going back to the very beginning of the pathway, really important that students understand is a thread of all of the four pillars throughout the whole pathway. One doesn't work in isolation. If I identify a need for change in the ambulance service, a clinical need for change, I can't just decide, actually, we need a new drug. There we go, there's the new drug. I need to go out and do some research to work out what drugs are available, what's safe or isn't safe, what's cost effective. There's the research bit. I do my research. I've identified a need for change with the leadership piece. I've identified a need for quality improvement. And after, I've used the negotiation, the stakeholder meeting skills that I've acquired. I then need to look at how we educate staff to use this new drug. And then I need to do small sessions. I need to do some media sessions, some social media stuff. I need to get people to sit down in a classroom with myself or one of the other APPs. I need to teach that drug, teach the complications, the challenges they might meet, but also the opportunities that come with that. And that's where all of the four pillars tether into one another. And this is just one example of a drug. This might be something else. There might be a behavioral situation. It might be a need for change in education. I mentioned earlier that we sit on a clinical hub, and as I'm talking to these patients on the hub, I might, after three or four shifts, think, hang on a minute, there's a trend here. Every time the patient tries to leave somebody at home who has comorbidities or has a head injury, okay, that's quite a classic one because we see that often. Elderly fallers, head injury, I want to leave this patient at home, but actually, they keep missing out on this key factor that they're on blood thinners or anticoagulants. Let's get the guys in and let's teach them a bit more about blood thinners, anticoagulant therapy, and also about what happens, the NICE guidelines, what protocols are out there to support these decisions, and also what would be done for these patients in hospital. I can teach them that in a specifically tailored session for the guys on my station. So that's really where leadership, education, and research come into play, to be honest. So,
but I would guess...
Forstår jeg det riktig at du tar ut små grupper?
I think it all depends on learning styles, and that's really where the education pillar informs me. How do certain people learn best? We learn about educational theories. That doesn't mean everybody's going to be a university lecturer. That just means that you understand. If you're in a one-to-one situation, I might talk to you, and you actually prefer to be a practical learner. You like to have hold the equipment. You like to be taught how the equipment works. You like to see it in action. Or actually, you like to sit down outside of the clinical environment, discuss what's happening, and then put it into play. People learn differently. And it's about understanding how people learn, but also understanding how I learn as a clinician. And I think that's really where we kind of deliver a lot of our education is done in an ambulance situation. Doesn't mean to say that it has to be one-to-one. It can be bigger groups. It could also be online, Teams calls now. We live in a large trust, much like you guys do. The distances are quite vast. Perhaps not as vast as you guys, but if you go from one end of the trust to the other, you're looking at least a three-hour journey, maybe more. I could get a Teams call for the groups and the teams there, and I could put a session on via Teams, and I could do that myself. I'm given time to do that. I might send a survey out to collect data, informing me of what staff want to learn the next opportunity. And there's the research piece. It's a smaller scale, but there's the research piece. I then do my own research about the subject itself, and I deliver that education, work out the best method of delivering it.
But I also guess that throughout a career, you will, and sometimes throughout your career, you'll be clinically quite involved, and then you say, you know what, now I'm going to spend more time as a training officer, and maybe you spend most of your time as a training officer, delivering training, sort of in-house training days, coaching other staff. You'll still do a few clinical shifts, but maybe the training part of your job will be more dominant, and then maybe you for some time go back to the clinical side, or maybe you'll take in a leadership role for a few years or a year, and then maybe you go, oh, I'd like to do sort of a quality improvement project, I've seen something I'd like to spend some time on, and then take that back as learning or into the clinical jobs. I guess it's not necessarily what goes on at any specific time of your career, but it sort of changes a bit throughout career. Now I'd like some more office time, less shifts, because this time of my career, that is more interesting or fits better with my work-life balance as well, I guess.
Completely, and we see a lot of our female colleagues who go through pregnancy and maternity, and actually, when you're leading up to the pregnancy, it's perfect to have a quality improvement project to work on. You aren't necessarily able to be clinically focused or clinically facing anymore for various reasons. You can't be lifting or be involved in the risk of sharp injuries and things like that. You can actually work on a project yourself, which is great. And it just makes you feel involved still, as if you're part of a bigger picture, which is really, you know, what we all want out of our careers.
So essentially, the four pillars of clinical work, educational work, leadership work, and research work, they're there all the time, but at sometimes you play on all of them and larger or smaller scale. In other parts of career, one of them might be more dominant than the other, and you might switch between these pillars
throughout your career, really. Is that right?
Exactly right. Yeah,
yeah, perfect. Yeah, so it makes absolutely, really resonates with me. I mean, I still work clinically. I love that. But in my beginning of my career, I worked 100% clinically. Mm. Now I work 50% part-time as an educationalist, as a teacher,
yep,
which I love. But I think I'm considering now I'd probably enjoy doing some research work. I think I've matured a bit. And one of these pillars will now have to sort of be reduced a bit so that I can use some more time on research.
And that's the danger, yeah, isn't it? The fact that we don't want to relinquish the clinical pillar because we're, yeah, so familiar with it, we love it so much, but I think sometimes you have to. I think, yeah, it's just part of it, really. Yeah. But yeah, as you said, through stages of career, growth, development, I'm in a similar situation in the UK. Mm. I probably spend 80% of my time in an educational setting and 20% clinically. Yeah. I also have some leadership roles where I manage staff, I manage students, I manage clinicians as well, and I think I'm able to draw in from all of those pillars, and it just fits in so nicely.
Mm. Yeah. I must say, this is, what I'm saying is absolutely true. I've been thinking about him for years. Mm. I mean, this is 2004, and I've been thinking about him since.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I meet the guy.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. That's
yeah,
crazy.
That's really cool.
Mm. Det jo mange vi møter her på Amlaks Forum. Ble vi nettopp avbrutt av en kar.
Bjørn Solheim, en flott fyr.
Første hjertestansen har hørt på.
Ja.
Så fortalte en historie der.
Virkelig masse, hatt masse følelser for den episoden, og alt det jeg lærte han den gangen, han har vært en av de menneskene jeg har sett opp til. Da. Ja. Så det var veldig hyggelig å se han igjen.
They say never meet your heroes, but it's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
You're my hero, det var det første du sa. Jeg skal inn på et foredrag ganske snart. Så vi må jo fortsette. Hvor var vi nå?
Vi snakket kort om the four pillars of practice, var det vi snakket om veldig kort.
Ja.
Og jeg tror egentlig at
vi kommer oss igjennom.
Det tror jeg, in English, the ownership is on the users, the advanced paramedics, to identify how they put that into practice. With the support from local management teams, because they can't just fly solo, you need to be working with for a bigger picture. But I think it's really good that the autonomy lies with us, not only clinically, but also professionally with the other additional pillars. So if you want to have a project, it's really key that you buy into it. Mm-hmm. You want to do it. You can see the need.
Og dette tilrettelegger arbeidsgiveren din for?
Yeah, so we have a roster. And there are days in the roster that are used for operational unit support.
Turnus.
So we see when these shifts are, and I can move them. If I need to go and meet a hospital lead or a care home lead, I can take that shift and move it down here, because that's a better day for meeting. So we have that flexibility, which is, I think, gives you freedom, and with freedom comes responsibility, as Spider-Man once said, I think. But it's important that you understand it's mutual, that kind of professional autonomy.
Mm.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And possibilities after we could talk about opportunities. You know, not only is it.
Fordi, altså du sa du hadde to altså utdanninger, og så kan man gå begge veier, men og både jobbe I ambulanse sånn som du gjør, eller som advanced.
Paramedics.
Ja, yeah. På enredder blir du egentlig da, med, som en sånn community paramedic.
Mm-hmm.
Eller du kan gå videre også, for du nevnte I foredraget ditt, I forhold til andre steder du kan jobbe. Det det du tenker på?
Ja, yeah, mm. Yeah. There's lots of opportunities in the UK, and I think it's taken decades for paramedics to become established as healthcare professionals in their own rights. Mm. They aren't just ambulance drivers. We're not seen as that anymore. We are seen as credible professionals, you know, that prescribe, that work autonomously, that manage their caseload. I think that's opened doors that perhaps nurses have historically taken the roles. We are now able to do those roles as well. Mm. I mentioned working on film sets. You guys already work on oil rigs and remote at sea, but austere environments, the military, the police, custody, prison services, as I mentioned, general practice, Elminlee, Leivaktos as well, so minor injury units, urgent treatment centres, hospitals. These are all now environments that paramedics will fit in quite comfortably.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Vi ser jo det begynner å komme mer og mer I Norge også, at man flytter seg altså fra ambulansen og inn på legevakter, sykehus har begynt å ta imot paramedics.
Absolutt, det finnes masse paramediciner nå som jobber på legevakter.
Ja.
Mm. Vi ser nå trenden også mot å begynne å jobbe I akuttmottak. Og det har hele tiden vært meningen. Hvis du ser på forskriften for paramedicinutdanningen, så står det I forskriften at utdanningen skal kvalifisere til ambulansetjeneste, luftambulansetjeneste, legevakt, akuttmottak og forsvaret. Så det jo helt analogt med UK. Mm. Men det klart at selv om utdanningen kvalifiserer for det, så det jo litt kultur med å begynne å ansette. Der har nok legevaktene vært ganske fremme I skoa og begynt å ansette mange paramedisinere. Mm. Så tar det nok kanskje litt mer tid med akuttmottak og andre steder. Mm. Men vi ser at trenden helt klart den veien.
Og da går det jo naturlig å komme inn på det du har snakket om I dag.
Ja.
Du, altså Oslo Met, det har jeg hørt det lenge, og I hvert fall av deg, jeg kjenner jo deg litt grann, så du bare...
men I dag det offisielt.
I dag det offisielt.
Oslo Met har tenkt til å starte en klinisk videreutdanning som avansert klinisk paramedisiner.
Og hva betyr det?
Hva betyr det? Nå skal vi si at avansert klinisk paramedisiner, det et arbeidsnavn. Det ikke sikkert det blir hetende til slutt. Men det klart at vi spiller på sykepleievidereutdanningen, som heter avansert klinisk sykepleie. Og vi ser for oss en rolle som analog til paramedic practitioner. Så avansert klinisk sykepleie spiller på nurse practitioner, og vi tenker å spille på paramedic practitioner, men vi har da valgt å kalle det for med arbeidsnavnet avansert klinisk paramedisiner. Det klart at ting ikke spikret enda, men vårt hårete mål å kunne starte innen 2 år. Vi har en hel del ting vi har en del tusen meters topper vi må bestige først. Vi har ikke landet en endelig studieplan. Så studiedesignet må vi fortsatt jobbe med, men det kan vi ikke gjøre alene. Det må vi gjøre sammen med andre aktører. Den første vi har fått på bordet nå at vi har en samarbeidsavtale med Stiftelsen Norsk Luftambulanse, og de kommer inn som en samarbeidspartner, og de støtter oss med fagstillinger, men vi samarbeider også, og de deltar også I å være med og bidra I studiedesignet. Så skal vi ha med oss andre organisasjoner inn, og så må vi selvfølgelig ha med oss representanter bredt både fra primærhelsetjenesten og fra spesialisthelsetjenesten. Så skal vi sammen designe den utdanningen, som går på innhold, opptakskrav, hvordan det skal gjennomføres, og scope, og så skal vi selvfølgelig gjennomføre den. Mm. En del økonomiske avklaringer det kanskje de største toppene akkurat nå. Men vi tenker jo at dette en utdanning, så selv om utdanningen kanskje ny, så tror jeg at mange av de jobbrollene som den akkurat har beskrevet, de har vi allerede I Norge. Mm. Vi har paramedisinere som kjører alene på bil. Vi har redningsmenn på luftambulanse. Vi har paramedisinere som jobber med legevaktsleger på legevaktsbiler. Så mange av disse rollene finnes allerede. Men vi tenker at de som jobber, jeg jobber jo en sånn rolle selv, og opplever jo at jeg jobber I en rolle hvor jeg ikke har fått tilstrekkelig med kunnskap for å fylle de skoene. Og det andre vi tenker at de rollene som allerede finnes, ikke fullt ut, det potensialet ikke fullt ut hentet ut der. Ved å tilføre en utdanning på mastergradsnivå, så kan vi utnytte det potensialet som ligger I eksisterende jobberoller I Ambulanse-Norge og I primærhelsetjenesten-Norge. Så dette synes vi veldig, veldig spennende.
Så det veldig viktig, altså nå har vi kommet såpass her, for vi har bachelor I, altså vi har fått en egen bachelor og kommet på master, og vi har begynt å få flere og flere som forsker på vårt nivå da.
Altså det akkurat du sier det, fordi vi tok inn vårt 10. kull nå I høst, ja. Og da passer det veldig fint at vi kan annonsere at vi starter en paramedisin mastergrad. Og hvis vi klarer å starte om 2 år, så vil det være omtrent når det 10. kullet blir uteksaminert. Mm. Ja. De vil uteksamineres om 3 år, så det en viss skjønnhet over det.
Ja. Ja. Og det klart at det spennende, og det fortsatt mye usikkert, men hva ser man for seg, ja, type, hvordan blir ting lagt opp etter master I 2-årsstudie, fulltidsstudie? Eller er man ikke der enda? Altså,
vi må bare være så ærlige å si at ting på tegnebordet.
Ja.
Jeg kan si noen
ting. Vi vet ikke noen fag eller type.
Jeg kan si liksom ting vi snakker om.
Ja.
Vi tenker oss at dette en utdanning som retter seg mot folk som allerede I arbeid. Og da tenker vi oss nok at dette må være en mastergrad som åpner opp for at man skal kunne jobbe parallelt. Og vi tenker oss jo nå igjen, dette tidlige tanker, men vi tenker oss at det naturlig at det en utdanning for hele Norge. Og hvis du skal kunne jobbe og bo andre steder I Norge, så det naturlig at det blir en del litt mer samlingsbasert. Så at man har mulighet til å ta noe remote, at du litt hjemme og har litt nettstudier, og at du reiser inn til samlinger for praktiske aktiviteter. Det kan vi tenke oss som naturlig. Jeg kan ikke si at det blir sånn, men det klart det en naturlig tanke. det blir på mastergradsnivå, og vi håper at den skal kunne lede til en full mastergrad. Det klart at det to år fulltid, eller fire år deltid. Mm. Og kanskje det mulig å lage en kombinasjon, at noen kan ta det heltid, og andre tar det deltid. Det må være litt opp til tegnebordet. Mm. Når vi tenker på faginnhold, så har vi nok latt oss inspirere av the four pillars of practice. Og det klart det kliniske kommer nok til å være en stor del. Men det skal være en mastergrad, så vi må ha forskningsmetode. Og dette kommer til å være, som Fredrik Hetman sier, forbrukere av forskning. Og skal du bruke forskning, så må du forstå forskning og kritisk analysere forskning. Så må ha noe kunnskap om forskningsmetode. Så det sånn at, with great autonomy comes also great responsibility. Det klart at med ansvar, med kunnskap kommer ansvar, og da tenker vi at du må innta lederroller, enten som prosjektleder, eller teamleder, eller enhetsleder, kanskje i perioder innta lederroller. Så vi tenker at skal ha et ledelses- og pasientsikkerhetsemne, og så har vi snakket om et emne som handler om læring. Mm. Fordi du må bidra til læring av dine kollegaer og din egen arbeidsplass og miljø rundt deg. Men vekten kommer nok til å være på de kliniske emnene, og vi tenker oss jo at de kommer til å spenne fra legevaktsmedisin til akuttmedisin, og at vi klarer kanskje å fange opp begge deler. Vi tenker at hvis du jobber på Finnsnes, så vil du, som akkurat som i Oslo for så vidt, rykke ut på eldre som har falt, urinveisinfeksjoner, feber, sårskader. Men det en trafikkulykke eller en hjertestand, så må du nok rykke ut på det også. Mm. Så du må kunne spille på begge strenger. Ja. Vi tenker at i Norge så har vi en tradisjon for gode generalister i front, og det det vi ønsker å støtte. Gode generalister i front der pasienten med høy kompetanse. Og så tenker vi nok, som den også var inne om, dette med det å kunne ha en karrierestige og det å kunne spesialisere seg, det tenker vi bra.
Mm. Dette her blir spennende. Jeg tror at vi runder av nå, for nå skal jeg gå inn og høre på neste foreleser her. Han har begynt nå for 3 minutter siden. Hjertelig, ikke velkommen. Nå begynner det å beslutte.
Det var en lang dag.
Takk for at dere gadde å sette deg ned. Og utrolig spennende å høre hvordan
dere jobber der nede. Jeg gleder meg også til å høre mye om 2 år.
Om 2 år.
Yeah. Ja, du er spent på utdanningen til Norge. Ja.
Det jo sånn at Dan jo her fordi han jobber som paramedic practitioner i South East Coast Ambulance Service, men han jobber jo også på St. George's University.
Ja.
Og sitter i ledelsen for ACP-programmet der. Så det klart at det jo fristende for oss å hente kunnskap og samarbeide med St. George's, noen som har gjort det før oss og som kan det, sånn at vi tenker et strategisk samarbeid også med St. George's.
Mm. Ja. Takk skal dere ha.
Selv takk.
Takk skal du ha.
Ha det.
Ha det.